The return journey to North America was entirely unlike the one going out. Physically, it was the same thing back to front, the same shipping line, much the same ports of call, but there the similarity ended. The ship on the return journey was carrying the full complement of passengers, putting an entirely different picture on the voyage. The other people were a group of retired North Americans who, having finally escaped the gilded slavery of the workforce, were intent on seeing the world by freighter. It is no doubt a very good way to see it, but they were tourists, not travelers. They filled their days with games, deck games, lounge games, the game of doing each port of call to the utmost, shopping and seeing. They were frenzied in their efforts to have fun, and appeared to have regressed to their high school days in their happiness at being released from work. I think we did our best to be polite, but very soon the conversation dried up. There was nothing to say, we did not want to join in their fun and would not have known how to, in any case, so we were written off as being dull and beyond comprehension. It meant that we kept largely to our staterooms, and that had an interesting outcome. We spent time with tarot cards, the crystal, and discussions about occult matters. These things were, of course, our life, especially Chen's, but normally we did not have time to have such deep personal discussions because we were focused on others, the research, the books, answering queries and attempting to help. Also, it is very possible that Chen's abilities were more heightened as we were actually on the ocean, almost a part of that majestic, unforgiving element. The higher vibrational senses of occultism must have flowed with greater ease and familiarly. He told me many things on that voyage, not only to do with my own life, but things in general to do with the planet at present, in the past and in the future. He used his crystal extensively, focusing the third eye as he gazed into it, receiving pictures, impressions and scenes, sometimes quite randomly and unexpectedly. When a skier, or crystal gazer, gets in contact, it is as if he or she falls into the scene presented. They are actually there in another dimension, and should never be disturbed. They are quite definitely out of themselves, they are operating in a different time. There were three things he told me, amongst the many, that stuck in my mind because I found them at the time difficult to believe, and just put them on hold until such time as they might, possibly, become more credible. They have, actually, all come to pass. It was not that I doubted his ability, it was simply that these three things seemed so very improbable. But life canons does take unexpected twists and turns. That is what makes it an adventure. It was when we docked at New York and left the ship, having to maneuver the docks and the seemingly endless formalities, that Chen first began to use a wheelchair. His back had been troublesome and he felt unable to walk and stand around, as one has to in such situations, so the wheelchair offered great relief, and when we were more or less settled again in Canada he purchased one. From New York we traveled back to Ontario, and this time put up at a rather sleazy hotel, quite curious, never a dull moment you might say, with all the comings and goings and carryings on of a varied clientele. Chen liked being around the man in the street, the common man, and these certainly were that, or perhaps the man in the tavern would be a more apartment description. This hotel was on the Niagara Parkway at a place called Prescott. It was a temporary arrangement that strung out much longer than intended, but in time we were moving again, this time to New Brunswick. Although there was a tremendous amount of fog in St. John, where we decided to live, the general atmosphere was much more pleasant than we had ever found Ontario to be. The people initially seemed unfriendly, but when they got to know you, they opened up. There was a natural reserve, which in the long run is a good thing, reminiscent of the Scots and their caution of strangers. It was a fishing town, hilly and healthy. We stayed at another hotel for a time, this one with the impressive name of the Admiral Beatty, and from there we found an apartment on a hill overlooking the sea, where we remained for a few months. Our belongings were minimal, as they always had been, but we had what was necessary for working. Although New Brunswick was not a bad place, in fact a pleasant place in many ways, it was too cut off for Chen. He felt he was wasting time, he had the pressing urgency to be where things were moving, a center. So, once again we packed up and were off, this time to Montreal. Of all the places I have lived in Canada, I found Montreal the most compatible. In my experience of Canadians, I have found them, for the most part, to be astonishingly, almost frighteningly, law-abiding. One could reason that this phenomenon is due to fear, but in the case of Canadians, I truly believe it is because they, as a nation, like to please, they hate to upset others, they are thoroughly nice people. If, for instance, someone is wanting to cross the street at dead of night, and there is no vehicle within sight or sound, they will solemnly wait until the walk sign comes on, with the little lit-up white person striding along, and then, and only then, will they cross the street, looking neither to left or right because they know the street is clear, the sign told them so. And besides, they are so law-abiding no one could possibly be running a red light, so it is perfectly safe to cross the street as soon as the walk sign lights up. But there is always an exception to any rule, and that exception, in my experience, was Montreal. I found a delightful piquancy to Montreal entirely lacking elsewhere in Canada. There were good concerts, people were interested in literature, antiques, art at a time when there was precious little anywhere else in the country. Culture was a natural part of the place, not something that people did because they thought they should be cultured. Enjoyment of life, joie de vivre, was natural, too. They seemed to look at life in a different way. They did not really try so hard to be nice, they liked to have a good time. We lived exactly the same kind of life in Montreal as anywhere else, that is, not mixing, living a reclusive life on the whole, but one still picks up an atmosphere and either thrives or subsides on it. I thrived on Montreal. It must have been 1968 or 69 when we moved there. For once, I am more or less sure of the date because we rented an apartment in Habitat. Habitat had been built for Expo in 1967, and now found itself almost empty. The rents had been astronomically high during Expo, and no one wanted to pay that amount of money for the pleasure of living there once Expo was over and done with. What was not generally realized was that Habitat had been put in the hands of Central Mortgage and Housing, a government-run agency, and the rents had dropped to a reasonable rate. Our apartment was a large one on the upper levels of Habitat, and situated at the far end with a marvelous view upriver and of any shipping coming down. It was, in fact, something like the deck of a ship, and unique in many ways. Chen kept a colored index of flags of the world pinned over his bed. Any ship coming in view was identified by its flag right away. The architect responsible for designing and building Habitat was Jewish and familiar with similar structures in the Middle East, but it was something of a wonder at that time in Canada. The apartments were placed in odd juxtaposition, never exactly alongside or directly above or below each other, and therefore individual and separate. They were not uniform in interior layout, some were on one level only, others on two, in some the bedrooms were on the upper level, in others, they were on the lower. Each unit had been prefabricated to design and then dropped into place by huge cranes as the building progressed. The whole place was constructed in concrete. There were glass-covered walkways, or streets, all around the building, and elevators which were reached by traversing the walkways. There was a central lobby which was manned by officers of the Corps of Commissionaires, and we found them very pleasant and helpful. When we first lived there was a limousine at the disposal of tenants, doing runs back and forth to downtown, dropping us at Burke's in the center of the city, and picking us up there on the return journey. Whenever I went downtown there were seldom any others tenants wishing to go at the same time, so I rode in the back of the limousine in state. When I was ready to go home, I called up and the car came to get me. In any case, only about four other apartments were occupied initially, but as the place filled up, the limousine was replaced by a bus running at set times only, but still free of charge. I unashamedly enjoyed it all. Rab really enjoyed it, too, although was always reluctant to admit to a liking for any kind of luxury. Chen found the place very suitable for several reasons. It was right on the water, the rooms and corridors were large and easy to maneuver by wheelchair. He had an electric chair by now, a Swiss-made machine and very dependable. It was a new concept in housing for this part of the world, and it was progressive. It was close to downtown, but there was still lots of parkland to explore, and the many outstanding expo pavilions which still were open, or some of them, in the summer months. He did not, and never did, enjoy luxury or fuss of any kind. But he was practical. He was disabled, and knew his body was already worn out, although he was not yet quite ready to give it up, so it was easy to live in comfortable surroundings where it was quiet and spacious. He liked to drive around the streets of Habitat in the wheelchair, which was possible even in the winter because the glass-covered streets were heated. He enjoyed the odd encounter with the people in charge of running the place, and I remember one such encounter very well. I nearly always accompanied him when he went out. He had suffered several brief blackouts recently, over in a matter of seconds almost, but he was loath to blackout while driving the wheelchair, or in a place where some well-intentioned person might send for an ambulance. So I went with him on foot, although later on I acquired a bicycle and we covered much greater distances together. This particular day we were about to take the elevator up to the top floor after a walk around the grounds, and an extensive and fascinating talk to the Swiss head gardener, or landscaper, as he probably would have preferred to be known. Chen had driven slowly, allowing me to keep up with him. This was prior to the bicycle, and we had already been out for an hour or so, and were feeling chilled by this time. As we waited for the elevator, a rotund little figure appeared around the corner, also heading for the elevator. We recognized him as M. Mark and, the representative of Central Mortgage and Housing, who was usually around the place, doing who knows what, but having his own little office close to the grocery store on the lower level. He was a bustling type of individual, with a permanent smile on his round, bespectacled face, and a habit of running his hand over his bald pate, seemingly to make sure every non-existent hair was in place. He spoke English with a very marked French-Canadian accent, but with such rapidity, constantly running off track, that it was never easy to follow his meaning. That was the main reason Chen did his best to avoid him. At this point, however, we were caught, and there was no escape. "Ah, well, how are you, doctor? A beautiful day, no? Cold, perhaps, but still so beautiful, so beautiful." He beamed and rubbed his head energetically. "And the beautiful young lady, well, I hope, yes, so nice to be young and beautiful." He was a pain, although unintentionally funny sometimes. We piled into the elevator together, subjected to his running commentary, but as soon as the door closed, shutting us all in and with no one else to hear, he became quieter and almost conspiratorial. Bending over Chen's chair, speaking close to his ear in a hushed voice, he said, "I would like to show you a very special little place here at Habitat, doctor. You like that, eh?" Chen regarded him silently for a moment, then to my great surprise he nodded and replied, "Yes, M. Mark and, I would like that very much." The little man continued smiling, and rubbed his hands together. "Well, now we send the young lady home, no? This is for men only, ha, ha." He giggled at his own remark, then seeing my ill-disguised look of boredom, he added, "You wouldn't be interested, no? This is business only, not for lovely ladies." The elevator door opened at the upper level, and Chen looked at me with the merest twink. "All right, I'll see you soon. I expect Rab has tea ready for us," he said as I stepped out, leaving them to it. M. Markand pushed the button after my exit and they returned to the concourse level. He got out first and Chen followed him. As he walked along beside the wheelchair, he got out a large bunch of keys, which he jangled as they went. It seemed to be an accompaniment to his endless conversation. "Ah, here we are," he announced as they arrived at one of the more secluded apartments, round the back of two others which occupied the best place on the concourse. He fitted the key, turned it and pushed open the door, beckoning for Chen to follow. they found themselves in what Chen later described as a very sumptuous place, fitted out like something one might see illustrated in an exclusive magazine. The carpet was so thick that the wheelchair made heavy going of it. There was a sideboard filled with bottles of alcohol, according to Chen, comfortable chairs, paintings on the walls. It felt as if it was used. M. Mark Hand took an easy chair and allowed Chen a moment to look around. So, Doctor, you like this place, eh? He inquired. Chen took his time. No, I can't say I do. It has a very strange atmosphere. A lot of people come here, don't they? And I can make one guess as to why they come. Well, you may be right, we are men of the world, aren't we, Doctor? We know what makes the world go round. Nothing wrong with that, nothing wrong at all. M. Markham sniggered. The oldest profession of all, you could say, and perhaps, yes, just perhaps, the most necessary. Doctor, you and I, we know about the world. Men must be kept happy. Men have to make decisions, big decisions, and they need to be kept happy so they can make good decisions. But, and I assure you of this, only the most important men come here, I assure you. Oh yes, only the best. Highly placed men, wealthy men. And only the most exclusive, mature ladies, for that matter, to entertain them. I see, said Chen, but I wonder why you have invited me here? Why? My dear doctor, can you not guess? Yes, surely you can. As I say, we have only the most exclusive ladies, and I just wonder, if your secretary... He trailed off, passing his hand over his head as he did so. My secretary? No, you are mistaken, M. Mark and... Chen laughed. Mrs. Rouse is a member of my family. She's no more a secretary than she's a prostitute. Oh dear me, please not to use that dreadful word. M. Markand extracted a handkerchief from his pocket and held it to his nose, as though the shock was too much for him. These are not ladies of the night, these are ladies of the highest, how do you say? Caliber? Is that the right word? I think so. Caliber. Of course I wouldn't think of offending, no, no. But the money, well, the money. We all need it, you know. And, rubbing his finger and thumb together, and with a sly wink, well, the money, it is considerable, I assure you. The young lady, I don't for a moment suggest she is a lady of the night, nothing like that. Here we are elegant, exclusive. Please, doctor. He looked pained as spoke, please don't use that vulgar word prostitute again. This is entirely different. Chen smiled. It may be a vulgar word, but it comes to the same thing. You need prostitutes. But I am afraid you are assuming too much. No, Mrs. Rouse would not be interested. And now am I have to get home, my wife has tea waiting. He steered his wheelchair towards the door. M. Mark and appeared undaunted. He shrugged, as only a French Canadian can, indicating that that was that. Too bad if the other was not interested, it was his loss. But he took the refusal in good part. As he locked the door, he half turned to Chen and said, just between ourselves. Of course, doctor, just between ourselves. No matter, I will still make sure you are looked after at Habitat. It lies in my hands, you know. His meaning was clear. Of course, M. Mark and... Just between ourselves. Have no fear. And you are right. We all need money. You get yours one way, I get mine another, and we won't interfere with each other. Now, if you will be good enough to send for the elevator, thank you. Good afternoon. When I heard the story, I just wondered if perhaps, after all, I had missed my vacation. It was a standing joke between us for a long time afterwards, and proved that perhaps one does not ever see oneself as others might see you, especially in Montreal. The time we spent in Montreal proved to be a hiatus in writing for Chen. There were different reasons for this. One may have been that it was simply necessary to have a pause, Another was that with his electric Swiss-made wheelchair and my bicycle we covered distances and saw things we might not otherwise have seen, so we spent a good deal of time on that, on going out and seeing things of interest. Sunday morning early was our favorite time to go to Old Montreal. There were lovely and interesting buildings, cobbled streets, fascinating names and odd corners, and there were few people around that early, which was a bonus. There was a large rampa following in Montreal, he was easily recognizable, so a deserted street was always welcome. During the weekdays we often went over the bridge from Habitat to the Expo site. Here again, it was pretty much deserted except at weekends in the summer, but there was still an enormous amount to see. The pavilions erected by countries the world over were still open sometimes, and many were quite lovely. And, of course, there was always the shipping to watch. And yet another and more serious reason for his rest from writing was that Rab experienced a prolonged episode of manic depression. The illness was generally under control, and who knows what caused it to recur in full force, but it did. Montreal and its vibrancy may have sparked an upsurge. Whatever it was, it began with a period of manic behavior, which I find as disquieting as the low period of depression that follows. It was the start of a difficult period for us all, and there were times when I would gladly have left and found a job, any small place to live on my own, just to get away. I was also troubled because of a new direction Chen seemed to be taking. For years he had shunned all publicity, a wise stance for various reasons, not the least being that in this way no one knew him, no one had met him, no one could truthfully make a statement about him, no one could say that he was this, that or the other because he remained isolated from the public eye. He wrote his books, and the time and effort that went into that was immense. He could complete a book quickly, but it had already been well thought out in his mind, and when he came to dictate it was always under tremendous pressure. The books, then, were one thing, but he felt that he as a person was of no interest. He was private and he fiercely guarded his privacy, but all of a sudden he agreed to a television interview. I felt strongly that television was not the kind of advertising he needed or should use. I felt it cheapened his image. His serious readers would be gravely disillusioned, I thought, and I told him how I felt. Looking back with hindsight, he probably had his own good reasons, but at the time I could see no reason good enough for his persistence. I could only guess. It caused a serious rift between us. He told me pointedly that a chain is only as strong as its weakest link. I was angry, hurt and disappointed. I had been supportive through thick and thin and still was, and to be classified as the weakest link was unjustified. But when I suggested any change in our living arrangements, that I move out and live alone, he displayed alarm, heart problems, anything to make me stay. We got through it, of course, and stayed together for many more years, almost to the end of his life. Looking at the painting now and seeing things more dispassionately, I believe he did have his good reasons and that my alarm was unjustified, even though at the time I was convinced I was right. During that period I spent a good deal of time in antique shops, boutiques, bookshops, and art galleries. The museum on Sherbrooke Street in Montreal was also the art gallery and had a system of allowing people to rent paintings. I went in for that for a time, not the old masters, they were not rentable, but nevertheless there were reasonably good paintings available for one to take home for a few weeks. When in the museum I often would sit and contemplate an El Greco painting which hung in an alcove. I have no idea if it is still there, but the peaceful, uplifting vibrations emanating from that painting were remarkable, almost hypnotic. Whether it was the work itself or the collective homage of the hundreds of viewers who had gazed on it over the years, I cannot say, but it existed and it eased one's mind. For another diversion, I sometimes had a rendezvous with a rather nice man who worked in one of the art galleries I visited, but then I found out he was married and an alcoholic, so not the best choice in the world. After a few years, Montreal began to pall and it was time for another move. This time we crossed the entire continent to the west coast, And it was here in Vancouver that Cheddon's illnesses took a hold and he entered the final phase of his life. Chapter 9. My magic painting is practically finished now. The story is nearly told, but the ending is as strange as the beginning. I do not understand fully what happened when I left Chen. Perhaps when I complete this life I will be able to understand. In fact, I am sure I will, but for now, with only limited vision, I believe that I did what I had to do. I fulfilled my commitment to him, and it was simply that time had run out. But I am running on ahead of myself. I am not quite there yet. My story is not quite finished. The picture is not complete in all its details. Chen and I had visited Vancouver once several years before we went to live there. We went as well to Victoria on Vancouver Island for a very brief visit, just a matter of days. We had planned to stay at the Empress Hotel in Victoria, and the Vancouver Hotel in Vancouver, but when we arrived he refused to enter either. They reminded him of British hotels, one in particular in India where he had been refused admission on the grounds that he was colored, a native. He had been deeply insulted. He was an intensely sensitive and proud man. As it happens, I do not believe we missed anything at all by bypassing those two hotels. I seem to remember us putting up at small, modest places which were much nicer. Victoria for Chen was not attractive. It was too British, too staid, too backwards looking, entrenched in a sort of pseudo-tradition more British than the British, and he was a man of the future. It was not the place for him. Vancouver, too, at the time we first visited was very conservative, very unaccepting of new thought, but by the time we went to live there it was beginning to change. It would be in the 70s that we moved from Montreal to Vancouver. I had by that time acquired one or two good pieces of furniture in old Montreal which I had no wish to leave behind. Although the Rampers disliked owning material things, Chen understood my love of old objects, something which sustains me in a world I sometimes find unbearable, and never tried to dissuade me from acquisitions, nor from hauling those pieces right across the continent, which I did. And they survived, they still survive. Even though they disliked owning things, it would not be correct to say that Chen and Rab did not shop. They did, but they seldom kept what they bought. What they bought was used and then circulated, given away to people who would appreciate it or who needed it, so when we moved, they moved with very little, the rest was left for someone else to use, and essentials, such as beds, were purchased at the next home. For Chen the monetary value was unimportant, it literally meant nothing. Monetary value to him was something artificial which had been put in place by the merchants and did not at all represent the real value. He had very little to do with money. Rab was the one who handled it, who went to the bank, who talked to the people who took care of money in banks. He knew what was going on, of course, but he seldom actually handled money. His shopping amounted to things for his work which I have already mentioned, but also things for hobbies, and books, clocks, watches. At one time he possessed some of the most beautiful and intricate watches and clocks I have ever seen, antique watches, old French and Swiss watches exquisitely decorated, perfect timekeepers, hour repeaters and even minute repeaters. He studied them, he studied their construction, he kept them for a while, and then he gave them away. As his health deteriorated, he bought and became very interested in aids for invalids. This was an ongoing state of affairs for a number of years, and I knew the inside of hospital equipment businesses in Vancouver, and later Calgary, intimately. I was the one who went to buy or exchange things he had seen in catalogues, Rab had discussed on the telephone, and then he obtained to test, not necessarily for his own comfort but for interest in the comfort of others in the same plight as he was in, or worse, in the plight of disabled people, to acquaint himself better with their lives. He relentlessly wrote strong letters to city officials demanding ramps on sidewalks for wheelchairs. When he first started using a wheelchair outside, it was dreadfully difficult to cross streets and alleyways because there were absolutely no ramps anywhere. One seldom encountered a person in a wheelchair in those days. They stayed indoors or on balconies or yards, and it was curious how a person in a wheelchair then, such as Chen, caused embarrassment to the fit and able. They turned away, they avoided us. Now, there are ramps everywhere. There are people in wheelchairs everywhere, and Chen was largely responsible for it. He never gave up writing to influential people on the issue of ramps and easy access for invalids, and he wrote letters which were hard to ignore.